Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a faithful conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Faith and is the belief or trust in something, most often a higher being like God. Globally, about 70 to 75% of the population believe in God or a higher power, and faith traditions represent about 84% of the population. There are about 20 to 25 organized religions and over 4,000 faith groups worldwide. The faith leaders have an important role in the issue of drugs and are underutilized as a group in drug prevention, treatment, and recovery. The importance of empowering faith leaders was recently highlighted at the National RX Summit. In a survey of faith leaders, 75% were approached at least once in the past year regarding mental health, and 94% of frontline clergy, 98% of theology school presidents consider substance misuse and addiction an important problem. And yet, only 12.5% received any training about substance use, and only 26% preach a sermon on the issue more than once per year. To learn more about the role of faith leaders and the issue of drugs, I reached out to Rabbi Eliyahu Shusterman. Rabbi Eliyahu Shusterman is the founder and director of Chabad in Town, Atlanta, Georgia. The Chabad Center provides various programs for Jewish life, like many Chabad centers around the world, and in addition is home to Jeff's Place Recovery Center. The rabbi was recently a speaker at the National RX Summit in a talk called Empowering Faith Communities to Tackle Addiction and Overdose, a replicable model for success. To learn more about Rabbi Eliyahu Shusterman, check out the High Truth show notes. I record this conversation with Rabbi Shusterman on June 20th, 2025. Rabbi Eliyahu Shusterman, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am excited to have you here. I saw that, you know, Chabad is at the RX Summit, and I'm like, what? I have to invite this guy. So thank you. And let's start with, you know, a traditional background. Tell us about yourself and your journey to becoming a rabbi and to being involved in the issue of addiction.
Sure. So I was born in Long Beach, California, 1973. I'm a young guy. And my parents belong, my family's tradition for many generations is in the Hasidic sect of the Jewish people, particularly known as Chabad. And Chabad, without getting into all of the mystical and traditional background, is an approach to Jewish faith that's focused on Jewish mysticism. And in particular, has always been dedicated to the Jewish community. At the core of the philosophy of Chabad is the notion of uncovering the divinity that's within the material world. So for all the generations, the last 250 to 300 years, the Chabad movement has always been dedicated to community in a variety of different ways. Obviously, the needs in the Jewish communities have changed from Tsarist Russia to communist Russia to World War II and saving lives during the Holocaust to ultimately coming to the United States. The sixth Rebbe came to the United States, the sixth in the dynasty in 1940, and dedicated the rest of his life till 1950 with a focus on bringing the Jewish people back into the Jewish connection, back into the Jewish fold. assimilation had been quite involved over many generations, and America was the great melting pot. And when the previous rebel was on the ship coming from fleeing from Nazi Europe, he made a pledge that America would not be any different and that we would restore Judaism to the United States and to the West. He passed away in 1950, and his son-in-law, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, fondly known as the Rebbe, became the new leader in 1951 and set out on this mission to really send emissaries throughout the developed world to set up Jewish communities, to move to respective communities and identify the needs in each of those communities, the social service needs, the religious needs, communal needs. And my parents were sent to Long Beach in the early 70s, which is where I was born. And that's where I grew up, in Long Beach, California. I was the rabbi's son, one of the rabbi's sons, because my parents were blessed with seven sons and four daughters. I was number two from the top. And my father was part of the founding of the first Jewish day school in Orange County. And that's where I went to school until fifth grade. Fifth grade, I started to travel to Los Angeles from fifth grade to eighth grade to a more observant day school there that was more in line with kind of our, the school that I went to that my father founded was more of an outreach school. The school I went to in LA was more of a religious school. And subsequently, I went to higher education, yeshiva in Los Angeles, Pittsburgh, New York. I went as a messenger student, an emissary student to France. And then I spent some time in Russia after the fall of communism, summer camps and Passover camps, high holidays, and then in a community known as Nizhny Novgorod, where we were involved in reestablishing the Jewish community there. And then I got married and moved to Atlanta, where I've been a Chabad rabbi since 97, doing all kinds of work here in the urban core of Atlanta, and I'm blessed with my own eight children, two sons, six daughters. Three of my children are married. We have four grandsons. We just had our fourth grandson was born last Wednesday, had his bris this Wednesday.
Wow.
And thank you. My wife and I feel very blessed and are very, very fortunate in so many different ways.
That's wonderful. You know, Chabad is, like you said, a Hasidic Jewish organization outreach with 5,000 centers around the world. But what you do is unique. The whole issue of drugs is not typical of Chabad centers. How did that happen?
So I actually think that in a certain sense, the work that we're doing in recovery is actually not unique because it's very much consistent with the Chabad mission. And maybe we'll wind our way back into that. But I'll kind of lay the groundwork for how we got here. So in 2015. On a Friday night, a young man showed up for prayer services, and he, after the services, he asked if he can come again, and I said, of course, and he started coming around on a regular basis, and eventually he started becoming more observant, following more of the Jewish traditions. He started coming every Saturday, he started keeping the Sabbath, he would stay over Friday nights, and just was a really nice, sweet guy. His name was Jeff. And just became part of the community. You know, generally in communities, you try not to pry. Everybody lives their life. And he would sit around after services at our kiddish luncheons and would share insights that he had learned. And he was a very humorous, lighthearted fellow. Anyway, about 2.5 years had gone by. And one Saturday, he was supposed to come for services and he didn't show up. And about 2 hours into the services, somebody arrived to tell us that Jeff had been found having overdosed and died from, had a relapse and died from an overdose. So Jeff's parents, particularly his mother, who I had a connection with, they live in Buffalo, New York, reached out to me and we planned the funeral. And again, I didn't really make much of, it was surprising and shocking that he was in recovery and had not shared it, but it didn't really strike me until the funeral when about 50 people from our Chabad community showed up and about 100 people from Jeff's recovery community showed up. And then later that night, we had a memorial service and there were 150 people from his recovery community, people who Jeff had sponsored, people who were sponsored by Jeff, It was just shocking to recognize that here was a person who had been part of our community and had never breathed a word about the fact that he was in recovery. And the story I told myself at the time was, here's a person who is so stigmatized in the Jewish community from the addiction that he found this new lease on life and wanted to keep his recovery world separate. Now, I had always been somewhat fond of people in recovery. I didn't know much about it, but over the years, as a rabbi, people would approach me. One of my closest friends is a gentleman who was in recovery since the age of 18. And when somebody would come along to me and say, hey, I'm struggling with this or whatever, I would always reach out to this fellow, Ken, and I'd say, hey, Ken, I've got a guy here. He's struggling. Ken would say, put him on the phone. I put him on the phone, and Ken would talk to him for about a minute. And then he would say, send him on his way. He's not ready for recovery yet. Or he would say, stay with him. I'll be there in 15 minutes. And he would come and pick him up and take him to a meeting. And that was pretty much what I knew. I understood that the challenge was a great one, and that people who had navigated recovery were really, in my opinion, heroes who faced this monster and were able to face it. But when Jeff passed away, this became much more acute for me, and I felt like I needed to do something. At the time, we were in the process of buying a new building for our center, and I reached out to Jeff's parents and said, hey, would you guys like to sponsor a space that would become a community gathering space for people in recovery? And they said that they would sponsor it, but the precondition was that we were going to invest ourselves in the work of recovery, so that it wasn't just going to be a space that was going to have a name on it, but it would actually be a space that would further the mission of recovery, specifically in the Jewish community, with the goal of minimizing the stigma associated with addiction and recovery. So we did that. We opened up in our new space. We named the in our new facility, we named the space Jeff's Place. And there was a gentleman in the community who's involved in AA who went through the steps of establishing an AA meeting at our center. Parenthetically, for 7 or 8 years prior to that, we were hosting a Sex Addicts Anonymous group, not specifically Jewish, but just randomly somebody had reached out to us and said, hey, the space that we've been doing our meeting, we're being kicked out. Do you guys have space to accommodate? And I said, sure. I was happy to accommodate. So we suddenly became this in our center where there were these meetings that were taking place. And actually the meeting, the room that I'm sitting in right now, as I mentioned, is called Jeff's Place. This is where the meeting takes place. And it's known today as the Beltline meeting. It's not a Jewish meeting per se, but it's a meeting that takes place in a Jewish space, which makes a barrier of entry for people who, for one reason or another, do not want to go to an AA meeting for whatever reasons, which we may talk about. It removes that barrier of entry. You're going to an AA meeting in a Jewish space. What's your excuse for not going? And it's become a very popular meeting, one of the more popular meetings in Atlanta. We've had some iterations. We've had a women's meeting. We've had a Two Hatters meeting. We continue to have the SA meeting. So that was kind of our foray into the space. And then subsequently, I was recruited by a fellow named Christian Thrasher, who heads up the Clinton Foundation's task force for the Interfaith Task Force for the Opiate Crisis, to sit on a panel of other faith leaders here in Atlanta. This was 2019 into COVID, into 2020, where over a period of 9 months, we were trained and educated in this around the space of recovery. We were each given a grant to be able to do a community-related recovery activity. And in that process, I began to study with two younger people in the community. We went through the Big Book, and then we went through the 12 and 12. And I really became educated.
Tell us what that is. What is the Big Book and the 12 and 12?
The Big Book is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. And the 12 and 12 is a fond name for the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, which is the basis of the actual steps of AA. But each one gets a chapter, and it goes through kind of what's the conversation that people are having inside their head and in their heart that is the barrier to executing on that particular step. And what I found in reading these steps and studying these steps is that so much of the 12 steps in particular which again, I know that there are many different paths to recovery. 12 steps may be a gold standard, but there are many paths. But the principles there are really tools for life, for somebody in recovery, and tools for life for anybody. And they're very deeply rooted in, I would suspect, in all faith traditions, but definitely deeply rooted in the Jewish faith. They're consistent principles with Jewish tradition and Jewish principles at large, and in particular in the Chabad tradition, the mystical tradition, the teaching of the Book of Tanya, which is the foremost book of Chabad philosophy, which is really the journey of the human being, the journey, you might call it a tale of two souls, which is really the nature of the tension that all humans have between living higher and living in the self-interest, and how to navigate that, which is really what addicts struggle with, like everybody else, only more so. They're spiritual principles of how to live life that help one navigate through that. So I was really fascinated by that and found such great depth in that. Subsequently, I taught a course, I developed a course on the 12 steps from a Jewish perspective to show how the 12 steps are rooted in our tradition, as they are in many other faiths. And then, long story short, because of my work with the Clinton Foundation and my relationship with Chris, I began to get recruited to speak at various different functions as an interfaith leader, as a faith leader with this interfaith panel at these various different conferences. And, most recently with the RX Summit, I was asked to sit on that panel with two other faith leaders to talk about recovery from a faith perspective. So that's the nickel tour of how we got to where we are today.
Yeah, that is amazing. It's an amazing that you have the perspective that it is part of the Chabad mission, because I think if you ask a lot of Jewish circles or any religious circle, there's an extra layer of stigma. They say there's stigma in using drugs, but I think in the religious circle, it's even more of a taboo. I could, it's interesting. Our Rabbanit, Rabbi's wife in San Diego, she is a social worker, and she had a nephew who passed away, and they said, oh, we think he died of suicide. And when I asked a little further, it turns out that it just did not sound like suicide, like dropping dead in a bathroom. It didn't sound like suicide to me. And I asked to speak to the family, and it was a fentanyl overdose, an M30 pill. And it was such taboo that they hid it, you know, from the Hatzala, the paramedics who came in, and they, you know, somehow, I don't know if suicide has less stigma than using drugs. And when I went into it further, this is like a very religious area of New York in Borough Park, I found out that there are 4 overdoses in that community in the same weekend, and nobody's talking about it. You know, you could really save a lot of lives if they did talk about it with prevention. But just because you're in a religious community does not spare you from addiction.
Yeah, I would say that religion is one form of a self-identifying group, but it's really any self-identifying group. It could be an ethnic group, it could be a religious group, it could be, you know, any kind of cultural group naturally creates its own definitions of what it takes, what's the exclusivity that creates this group. And every self-defined group wants to protect its definition. And when you have something that people are unfamiliar with, that kind of is creeping into the group, the natural tendency is to say, wait, that's not us, right? That's an anomaly. And the reality is that we know today that addiction affects everybody. It affects every level, every economic level, every religious level, every ethnic level, every nationality. And that's because inherently addiction is part of the human condition, where all humans are guilty of some form of addiction. It doesn't necessarily have to be a substance or an overt behavior, right? Whenever we are feeling uncomfortable, the natural tendency is to find a way out of our discomfort. So some people will do that by going to the gym. Some people will do that by, you know, drinking coffee. Some people will do that by, you know, expressing anger, manipulation, control, But they're all just different forms of behaviors that are designed to escape the discomfort. And the addict, none of those things really work for the addict. And until they engage in the substance or the harmful behavior, that's when they find temporary relief. And, you know, and that's really what struck me so much about reading the Big Book and the 12 and 12 is this idea that this condition is the human condition, and we're all part of it. And just like each of us, if we're not in recovery per se, in other words, we're not struggling with a named addiction. If we were to look at that behavior and say, I want to get control on that behavior. Let's say I struggle with anger, and I say I want to get control on my anger. That's not a one and done. It's not like, oh, I made a decision and now I'm never going to get angry again, or I'm never going to express anger again, right? This is deep work that one needs to do to be able to figure out where the anger is coming from, and then to learn techniques to eliminate the anger, to have the anger dissipate. The same thing is true with addiction. It's what's going on inside of me that's pushing me to engage in this harmful behavior. What am I uncomfortable with? What's the discomfort that I'm running away from that I'm trying to settle? So I think everybody's party to that. And the question is, are we willing to face that and look at the tools that are available to us? And again, when you're talking about an addiction, which is commonly termed a disease, it's something that's more deeply rooted than just a behavior. There's something deep inside that needs resolution.
Yeah. Well said. I think a lot of people relate to that, and for a lot of things, like you said, anger, food, gym, whatever else that we use for coping. Jeff's Place is a place for recovery. You said of all sorts of things, all types of addiction. Is it just for Jewish people, or is it just for people who believe in God?
No, none of the above. So let's qualify. Jeff's Place is both a physical space, but also an organization. It's an organization that's dedicated to minimizing stigma in the addiction community, in the broader community. But our mission specifically is Jewish focused. Not exclusively, in other words, there's all kinds of wonderful organizations that are dedicated to minimizing stigma in the broader world. My focus, my passion is my community, the Jewish community, to help minimize the stigma in the Jewish community. The way to do that is by not creating further stigma. And further stigma would be, we're only doing meetings for Jewish people, right? What we're trying to say is, hey, this is not a Jewish problem. This is a collective problem. So when we have our meetings here, first of all, AA, you cannot be denominational. If you want to belong to the official Alcoholics Anonymous body. But in addition to that, I want people to come in here and look around the room and say, wow, there's whites here, there's blacks here, there's Christians, there's Muslims, there's Jews, there's people who are atheists. And they're all on the same journey, because we're all humans trying to figure out how to navigate this thing called life with the complexities that each of us are dealing with. Now, we do certain programs that are focused on the Jewish community. We do a program called Quieting the Silence, which is designed to have people come in and share their story. And again, it's open to the broader community, but our goal is to get the Jewish community in to hear these stories so that people could become more familiar. You know, at its core, minimizing stigma is not like this, it's not like this big event that you do and the stigma is minimized. Minimizing stigma is by saying, hey, this is, like you said before, this is not taboo. This is something that we need to speak about because it's just part of life. You know, the common analogy that's used is, if God forbid somebody has cancer, we don't say, oh, you know, that person's got a problem. No, they've got an illness that needs to be treated, and no one is going to shame them for having an illness. Addiction is the same kind of thing. The person that's struggling with this has a challenge that needs help. And there's nothing wrong with the fact that they have that challenge from a moral standpoint. So we ought to be there to help them the same way we would be there to help, the common person who's struggling with their financial situation, or some other mental health issue, or homelessness, or, you know, whatever else, a relationship issue, right? We're here to help people find a way to get themselves more anchored in their core, in their soul, in a connection with a higher purpose and so on. So it's not exclusively Jewish, even if our mission is to help minimize the stigma in the Jewish community.
Got it. And you have separate like meetings at AA, NA, you said a sexual addiction, SA.
So the two official meetings that take place is AA and SA. The other meetings, so we've had a women's meeting, which I believe was an AA meeting. And the two Hatters meeting was a multiple, you know, people of different kind of backgrounds. And we're actually trying to get some additional meetings started here. And we're open to it. In other words, we want to be a place, mission driven. We want to be a place where people know, hey, this is a place where you can go to find community, where you can find fellowship, and really navigate the journey of life.
Yeah. Interesting. So, and I don't know why I'm assuming, and maybe I shouldn't, that Jeff passed away from fentanyl, just because that's the most common drug that people die from these days.
I don't know if it was fentanyl. I don't know. I don't remember exactly what it was.
Yeah. So NA, but another growing thing, and I did a podcast on that, is MA, Marijuana Anonymous, if you talk to people, especially young kids whose children are using marijuana, getting addicted to marijuana, getting in trouble with marijuana, if you want more information about that, I can tell you about those kind of meetings and information if that's a need for your community. It's a younger demographic that,
yeah, it's much more available today than ever before.
Yeah. Or the other meetings, and I don't know if you're involved in those, the Al-Anons, for the parents and loved ones who have someone who's addicted to alcohol or narcotics or marijuana.
Yeah. Familiar.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So as a rabbi, studying the Bible and also sort of a biblical text, what does the Bible, the Torah, say about drugs, alcohol, and addiction?
Well, let's start with the premise. What's the problem with any of these substances, any of these behaviors? At its core, it damages the body, right? And especially in the mystical tradition, but even in basic Jewish tradition, our bodies are given to us by God to be the home for our soul for the time that we're on this earth. And our bodies are not ours to do whatever we want with. In other words, it's a gift from God for us to help us journey this thing called life. And we don't have the right to harm our bodies. So on a very basic level, as long as we are alive, we have a responsibility to care for our bodies. There is a verse that says, "Ushmartem b'snafshei seichem," you should guard your soul, your spirit, which means guard your life. Our bodies need to be, the term that's used is, you know, our bodies are a temple. It's a sanctuary, and it's a place where God rests. So we want to make sure that just like your home is clean and orderly, just like a synagogue and a temple is a place that's clean and presentable and respectable and a place that, so to speak, God can feel at home. Our bodies need to be a place that God can feel at home. And therefore, we have a responsibility to take care of our health and our well-being. So that's on a basic level. But on a deeper level, each of us are put on this earth for a purpose. And the purpose is to be present, to be conscious in our lives, and to find divinity, to find godliness, to find meaning and depth in everything that we encounter. Unfortunately, part of that journey is darkness and challenge. Nobody gets through life without challenge. It could be a relationship challenge. It could be a health challenge that is put on us, not a health challenge that, God forbid, we put on ourselves. Financial challenges. You know, everybody goes through life and we face all kinds of different challenges. Our job in those challenges is to say, where is the godliness in this challenge? Where is the purpose and the meaning of this challenge? How do I turn this encounter, how do I turn this event into something that can help me fulfill my purpose on this earth? Because that's where life is lived, in the present, in the moment. When we engage in behaviors or engage in bringing substances into our body that alters our ability to be present in that journey, we're violating, so to speak, the very purpose that we were put on this earth. And in fact, when we're able to face that discomfort and not run away from it, that's when we discover our purpose. When we're able to look at the darkness around us, let's take a classic, a relationship challenge, right? When you're facing a relationship challenge, and instead of running away from the challenge, you say, why am I having such a difficulty in this relationship? What is it about me that's being so triggered from this person? What's coming up for me in this exchange? And let me try to navigate that. And then we do navigate that. We suddenly discover a part of ourselves that weren't familiar with before. And then we can show up in a much healthier, more present manner. And then when we show up that way in that relationship, we then show up that way in many other aspects of our lives. So what do they say is the addiction is not in the way, it is the way. There's such a statement, I believe, in AA, right? The challenge is not in the way, it actually is the way. It's not designed to bring us down. It's actually designed to propel us forward. But it's only going to propel us forward if we value that and value our bodies and value our purpose. Then we can face all these things and say, okay, how am I going to navigate this in a way that's actually going to help me further my purpose and further my mission on this earth? So in terms of the Torah, in terms of the Bible, where this shows up, it's at its core, the very creation of the human being and the purpose of creation, which is to make the world a godly place, to make the world a sanctuary. I'll tell you an interesting passage. When God instructs the Jewish people to build a sanctuary in the desert, there's a very interesting use of language there. The Torah says, God says, make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell within them. It doesn't say I will dwell within it. There was a single sanctuary, that this portable synagogue that accompanied the Jewish people in the desert. But the Torah doesn't say, God's instruction isn't make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell within it. It says make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell within them.
Us, which is us, right?
Correct. And our sages say within each and every individual, when we make ourselves and our corner of the world into a sanctuary, that's where God dwells. So each of us is a sanctuary. Each of our little microcosm is a sanctuary. And we need to make it into a sanctuary so that God can be present there. The way to get there is just like you build a sanctuary. You it's all that hard work. You gotta collect the wood and fabricate all of the various different vessels. We do that in our own lives, in all of the different ways that we live life. We learn an occupation. We invest in relationships. We learn how to navigate our inner world. When we do that, we are making ourselves into a sanctuary, and it's not like God suddenly descends upon us. It's God's inside of all of that, right? That's at the core of it, but we don't get in touch with that until we're ready to peel away those layers.
That's very nice. I don't even have to ask the next question. I was going to ask you, do you talk about the issue of addiction in your sermons? But I could tell already that it just probably comes natural to you to include that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'll actually tell you one of the things that comes up recurring in the presentations that I do with the other faith leaders. The question that's always asked is, what are the tools that you would advise other faith leaders? So I don't get up and give a sermon about recovery, but the language of recovery, because I'm familiar with it and because I find it to be such a powerful tool for life, it naturally finds its ways into my classes, into my sermons, and so on. And the beautiful thing about it is that somebody who's sitting in the audience that hears that, that's struggling and is familiar with the language of recovery, a light bulb goes off in their head and says, here's a safe person that I can talk to share my struggles with, because they know what I'm going through. Yeah. And they're clearly going to be sympathetic, if not empathetic, to what I'm going through, I'm going to open up, because we know that addiction lives in the darkness. It lives in the secret. It lives in the loneliness. And that's the most painful thing, is for somebody to have to navigate anything in life alone and in darkness. And knowing that there's somebody that they can talk to and bear their soul to is the first step of recovery.
Yeah. You know, I could totally see that when at first you said, you know, the language of recovery is already ingrained in the way we talk. I didn't understand what you meant at first, but now I do, because in any religious sermon or theology, the whole purpose is making yourself a better person, you know, making, you know, a meaningful life in this world. And so you're always trying to fix and better yourself, whatever it is about you. It doesn't have to be about drugs, but I see that analogy now and that struggle. And also the beauty, because when you do that hard work, and probably what attracted you to working in recovery in the first place, when you see people who've gone through the really hard work to go through steps to reach recovery, you become a beautiful human being. And you see that and appreciate the work that went into that.
Yeah, I'll add that one of the things that attracted the space of recovery to me, beyond the technical circumstances with Jeff, is the fact that I consider myself a struggler. Not necessarily struggling with addiction, but the struggle of life. Mm-hmm. And these are the tools that are core to Jewish tradition, and again, in particular, Chabad philosophy about how to navigate life. How do we navigate life? What are the tools that we need to be able to face a challenge and to not be crushed by it, but to find purpose in it and find meaning in it and to navigate that? And when you know, if I have a character deficiency or flaw that I am struggling with, I'll make some progress on it, but it's not going. It hasn't disappeared, right? I may graduate from one level, but it's still going to be there. And then you have a person who's using a substance, and they have to stop entirely, and they do that successfully. That's mind blowing.
Yeah.
That's so heroic to be able to do that. And, you know, we know the difference between, you know, somebody who's in recovery versus a quote unquote dry drunk, right? You know, some people have unbelievable self-control, but that's not enough. I mean, it's enough not to die, but it's not enough to live life. And the beautiful people in recovery are those that are actually doing the work. And they're the most beautiful people who are willing to face the deepest, darkest stuff of themselves, inside themselves, and to be able to, you know, laugh at it. It's one of the things I've gone to a number of AA meetings, and I love the self-deprecating nature of people, where they talk about something that they did or some inner struggle, and they're willing to laugh at that, because life is funny. People are funny. I'm funny. My you know, if you look at your own character, you say, wow, it's hilarious that I faced that yesterday, and yet here again, I'm looking at that same character flaw and about to behave the same way. It's like, what's wrong with you? Like, and it's funny, not in a ha-ha way, but it is humorous. Like, so I think when we can really dig in like that and face who we are without shame and recognize that this is the journey of life, we turn to people who've really mastered that, at least in one space of their lives, and do it heroically every single day. And it's so mind-blowing. And I have such respect and awe for people who go that journey.
And, you know, and yet there remains a stigma. And I would say it's even larger in a religious community than it is in the general public. I think in the United States, we've really worked on the issue of stigma and have gotten better. Maybe even gone too far, but that's another conversation. But like when that tragedy happened in Borough Park, and there were, you know, four deaths of fentanyl in one community, I thought, you know what, people should have naloxone, or people should be talking about it, or they should be talking about preventions or the dangers or recognition, and that was shunned away. I tried to write articles several times in Jewish magazines, and people don't They don't want to hear about it. How are you facing that among your colleagues?
So I have to tell you, I don't know how many years ago that particular story was, but I am actually find that, especially in the more observant communities in the Northeast, they're actually embracing it far more than the secular Jewish community is. There are a lot of meetings that take place. There's a lot of conversation. I've written articles for a number of different publications, and they've published them. And I think it's coming out of the shadows. Maybe not as fast as you and I would like to see it happen, but I think that, look, we live in a world today. I was just thinking about, you know, what's going on in the Middle East right now, and looking at, you know, where we're getting our information from. Just parenthetically, so somebody showed me this app where you can track planes that are flying anywhere in the world, and you can isolate military planes, right? So before, you know, once upon a time, warfare, people would stealthily, armies would stealthily put their ammunitions or their planes into enemy territory. Today, you can't hide it. Everybody knows about it as it's happening, right? We live in a world that's so exposed today. Everything's exposed. So the whole notion of keeping this thing a secret, it just doesn't work anymore. And the resistance, you know, you hold on, the resistance to the secret is only as long as you can actually keep it a secret. Once you can't keep it a secret anymore, the resistance begins to crumble. And then people are willing to face the damage of whatever those things that were being kept as a secret are holding on to. Look, we live in, let's look at a very interesting area in society today, mental health. Mental health, everybody's talking about it today.
Yeah.
Right? 20 years ago, they didn't talk about it. If somebody had a mental health issue, depression, anxiety, you go to a therapist, don't tell anybody. That's a secret, you know? It was embarrassing. Now everybody's, my therapist, everybody, it's like a badge of honor. You talk about your therapist, right?
Yeah.
Mental health, one of the challenges I actually find right now in the recovery community is that there's a willingness to give money to support mental health, but people in the broader community, not Jewish community per se, the broader community still sees addiction as a moral failing. And if you see it as a moral failing, you say, get your act together. Why should we give money to help you figure out how to get your act together? We're going to give to mental health because those are issues. Those are like cancer, right? You know, somebody's got depression or anxiety or bipolar. You know, that's something we should throw money at because it's not their fault. But just stop drinking the alcohol. Just stop using the drug and you'll get a grip on it. It's ignorance, of course. But my point being is that it's only a matter of time that those walls are already crumbling. And I do think that I've not encountered any resistance at all. No one said a negative word. A lot of people have reached out in the Jewish community, in the Chabad community, wanting to follow our model and to try to bring what we're doing to their own communities. I'm actually much more optimistic in terms of reducing the stigma. I think that we're moving forward in a significant way in helping reduce that stigma. I think we've got a problem with accessibility to drugs today more than ever before, and the fentanyl, and there's a lot of problems on the on the providing side. But I think in terms of the recovery side and awareness and stigma, I think we're actually making tremendous progress. There's a long way to go, but I think the journey has begun in earnest, and I think we're going to see it accelerated in the coming years.
Yeah, and focusing, investing in the recovery community, I think is important. We have 20 million Americans living in recovery. They're a testament that, you know, that it works. And I also think that that's the body of people we should be studying on how to best treat. You know, we tend to throw drugs and medications on things, but there's a role. I'm a physician. There's a role for that. But a lot of the people who've reached recovery did that without medications and not just opioids. And that's a group we should be studying for answers. Now, the other side of things is prevention, primary prevention. And I know you have grandchildren, children, and day schools and preschools associated with Chabad. I'm wondering, with your experience, if you're investing in primary prevention, teaching kids to stay away from those kind of dangers.
Yeah. So there's I think there are two different layers to maybe even three layers to prevention. I'll work backwards. The most technical and in a sense least significant is things like naloxone, getting that into
and
spaces.
I don't even consider that prevention. That's just life saving. That should be across the board. I mean,
you're gonna die.
That's everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's utilizing tools like that to bring awareness to communities. The second layer is once the struggle's begun to have a peer-to-peer kind of exposure where again the stigma is what, and by the way, when we say stigma in this context, it could be a child who's carrying some shame around the grades that they're getting in class. That becomes a slippery slope. But it's the idea that young people have whom to talk to about the fact that they're struggling with something. So building a peer-to-peer, and let alone if they're already experimenting with substances, that they have a peer, there's an environment that it's safe for them to have a conversation with someone else. And it becomes something that's more accepted and popular to engage in the conversation, to be proud of the fact that I've faced a particular challenge and that, I'd love to see young people, just like they're okay saying, hey, I go to my therapist, to be able to say, hey, I go to my peer and we've had a conversation about what I'm struggling with. But I think at the core, where so much of the issue lies with a lot of mental health issues and substance use abuse, really boils down to living for something. The tension that exists in the addict, which again, when I writ large, the human condition, is this tension between me and purpose, or you might say between my body and my soul, right? My soul is driven to live higher. My body is preoccupied with self. And that's where the tension lives. My body is feeling uncomfortable. My soul doesn't want me to engage in, let's call soul, others would call it spirit. My soul wants me to live higher, but my body is preoccupied with its discomfort. So what am I living for? What is my higher purpose? What am I doing on this earth, right? Do I have a relationship with something outside of myself that makes life worth living, that makes life meaningful and purposeful? And I think that that's where we need to be educating young people. What is life all about? What is our purpose on this earth? And it doesn't have to be, the Jewish mission per se, but it's just, I'm here to be in service to humanity, to be in service to making the world a better place, that it's not all about me, right? A child comes into this world and it is all about them. That newborn child needs to feed, needs to have a diaper changed, and it's me, and they cry and they scream and it's all about them. At a certain point, we start to educate the child, no, it's not all about you. You're here for a purpose. And hopefully as we navigate adolescence, we begin to get that message. But that message is not necessarily taught. In religious circles, it is taught because it's part and parcel with our tradition. It's not always taught well. And sometimes it's taught very dogmatically, which doesn't digest into the child. But if it's taught in a healthy way, in a beautiful way, in an uplifting way, it becomes transformative. So, suicide is very, very prevalent, unfortunately, today. And again, I don't have any judgment, because I really get the struggle, but there's a certain notion that somebody has to have at some point that there's more to life than just me and my pain and my discomfort. I'm here for a purpose, and not just, as I mentioned earlier, I don't have a right to take my life because it's not my body; it's a gift that's given from God. But there's other people that are affected by this. There's other people that are affected by my drug use, by my alcohol use. There's other people that are affected by my preoccupation with how I'm feeling today. You have people walk into the room, how you feel. People carry their moods into a room. Like, keep your mood at home. It's not everybody's problem that you're going through a struggle. We're here to help you share your struggle. We want to be in service, but don't bring The whole world doesn't revolve. There's a beautiful teaching. There was it's said in the name of many different great Hasidic masters, but you know, I think it's name said in the name of a certain Rebbe who's known as the Kutzke Rebbe, where he had a paper in each pocket. In one pocket, it said, the whole world was created for me. And in the other pocket, it said, I am but dust and ashes. You know, these are passages from our tradition. But the notion is, on the one hand, God created the whole world for me, not in a selfish way, right? I'm here to, everything I see is perfectly designed for me. But I must maintain my humility that I am but dust and ashes so that I recognize that that whole creation is for me to be in service. Yes, I have feelings. Yes, I have a body. Yes, I have anxiety. I have depression. I have discomfort. I want to escape this uncomfortable place that I'm in. And I'm going to try to find a way to do it in a productive, healthy way. But I don't have the right to just indulge just to get out of my discomfort because it's not my body and there's other people affected by it. So I think so much of the teaching actually goes down to the very core at a young age to begin to educate young people that life is more than just me, me, me. You know,
yeah.
I'm here to serve in some other fashion.
I like that. I do think that that is a very important aspect of primary prevention, not of just drugs, but of, you know, good mental health.
Sure.
Just like you're saying that if you are, also if you're pride, I mean, I think we do when we talk about this generation of kids who are growing up with depression and severe anxiety, because they're always like, they're doing something wrong. And instead of being, you know, being proud of whoever you are, whatever you are, and have purpose, I think that's great prevention. But also, as studies have shown, that if your parents, your rabbi, your teacher tells you, you know, don't use drugs, it's not healthy, protect your brain at least till you're 25 years old while it's growing, that carries a huge credibility with children who otherwise, when life gets hard, you know, they reach out for anything, and we all have struggles no matter who you are. But teaching that primary prevention, you're going even more upstream than that and just having pride and purpose in who you are. So, like I said, I saw this Chabad rabbi at the RX Summit, and you're sitting next to an imam, a Muslim, cleric, and this is right after October 7th with things are uncomfortable between at least the extreme ideologies. What was that like for you?
Yeah, I'm unfazed, meaning, you know, I think that, not to go down that rabbit hole, but I think the West, a lot of the West doesn't really understand what the tension is. It the Jewish faith is an extremely embracing faith. Yes, we have our path, but we're embracing and very accepting. There are many paths to God, and God is big enough to contain all of it. Where things deviate is when people are looking to perpetrate evil. And one of the beautiful things about this particular task force that I was recruited, as mentioned earlier, by the Clinton Foundation, is that we're sitting around the table with a lot of good people of different faith traditions with all the same mission, which is to minimize stigma in our respective communities, to save lives and help people along. So the imam and the minister that, you know, the three of us have actually spoken at many conferences together. And wonderful people, really dedicated to their communities. And I would tell you that if I thought that in any way that imam had had an agenda with me or with any good people, I wouldn't sit next to him. But he's a good person, and I have no in other words, I don't want to overstate or understate that. There's plenty of good people out there. There's plenty of good Muslims out there, all really in the pursuit of peace and goodness and want to coexist and want to live together and want to do good for our respective communities. So it's a non-issue for me.
Right. And I guess you have the purpose that connects you and you don't talk, I assume you don't talk politics or maybe it's interesting to talk politics and theology since you guys get together a lot.
I not so much. In other words, I don't, I, I, I don't find a lot of value in, you know, I think like this, again, this is going down that rabbit hole a little bit, but I think politics, you're very rarely going to convince somebody who has a different political view than you to come over to your side of things. You're even less likely to convince somebody who has a different religious view than you to come over to your side of things. So as long as they're doing no harm to you or to other good people, let's focus where we can collectively make the world a better place. And we're all God's children. There's plenty of work for all of us to do. This world's got enough problems that if we focus on where we can join together to do good in the world, we're going to make the world a much better place.
Right. That's very nice. And you know what? One of the things I tell people, you know, we all believe in the Messiah. So when he comes, we could just ask him, is this your first time or is this your second time? You
know? That's great.
So empowering faith leaders, Clinton Initiative. Clinton sounds partisan. Is that a partisan?
Well, I would say to the same end goal, right?
Yeah.
You may be a Democrat or a Republican. There are plenty of past Republican presidents and plenty of past Democratic presidents that have done wonderful things for the world while in office, and wonderful things for the world when they're not in office. You know, if your politics don't align, you may not want to participate in the political. You know, again, I think today, even more than when Clinton was president, the polarization politically is so terrible that people, you know, really, there's the classic image is of a bunch of Israelis sitting at a cafe in Tel Aviv, and they're screaming like they want to kill each other about some political issue. And then they finish and say, okay, let's sit down and have lunch. And they're best of friends. And a minute earlier, you thought one guy's going to jump up and tear the other guy's neck out.
I've seen it. It's scary. And then they hug each other. And it's like, whoa.
So we used to live in a world where people could have different political views and still see the good in the other. And it's become so polarizing. So, you know, there are things in the space of recovery that have become politicized, no question about it. There's also things in the area of recovery that are debatable. You know, in other words, this is an approach. There's a lot of question around regulation and various different kinds of, you know, fundings and stuff like that. Look, it's all open for debate. I wasn't recruited by the Clinton Foundation to lobby, you know, to lobby the government. I wasn't recruited to get involved in any of that. I was recruited to be involved in one specific thing: empowering faith leaders to be better equipped to deal with our respective communities, to be a resource and a guide to help those struggling to find the path to recovery, to help minimize stigma, to help support recovery, to help in the space of prevention. And I don't care if your name is Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan or George Bush or anybody else, if you're furthering that mission, I want to be a part of that. And if you're furthering anything that's apolitical, but that is in the service of humanity in a good way, I'd love to do it. You know, at our Shabbat table, we have people of either political leaning, and whenever somebody brings up a political conversation at the Shabbat dinner, the first thing I say is, we don't talk politics at our Shabbat table. I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. That's not the environment. I don't want this to become a point of tension. I want to have conversations about things that bring people together, you know, worldviews, religious conversations, how can we live life more fully and so on. And I think that if we can stay focused on that, we will help the world. We will make the world a better place.
That's right. And it sounds like you're doing beautiful, important work and in a way, making the world a better place by, you know, understanding people, promoting recovery, prevention, all the work that you're doing, bringing religions together on it for a common purpose. I think that's beautiful. So, anyone is making that political, that's petty. And, you know, at the beginning of the conversation, I had to play a little bit of Jewish geography and ask you if you know the Rubenfelds, and I knew she got married, but I heard you're from Long Beach, so I did persist further. Marcus family, Yossi Marcus is a good friend of you. Yeah, so he's brothers with Bluma Rubenfeld, who lives in San Diego and who I've known for many years. And I knew that if I dug a little deep, I'd figure out the connection.
Yes, yes. Yossi's a classmate, and we grew up together. And I know Bluma. I've been out of Long Beach for many, many years.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly who's married to who, but yeah, that's beautiful, wonderful.
Yeah. So Bluma's a good friend and wonderful people in San Diego. So what would you want to know? What would you want Americans and the world to know about this issue? Just in a summarizing thought.
You know, there's a passage in the Talmud that actually is on our website that I think carries the core of where each of us can make a difference. And the Talmud says that one who saves one life saves a world. And, you know, sometimes when we look at a problem, we look at it as like, wow, this is an existential problem for all of humanity. And we're never going to conquer this. And I'm not going to tell you that we're going to conquer it. I don't know that we're going to conquer the problem. But can you make a difference in one person's life? We never know. I'll share a recovery story. There was a fellow who we did a sober Shabbat some years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And there was a fellow there who got up to share his story. And he said that he met me when I moved to Atlanta in 97. And we had done a Shabbat dinner. And after the dinner was, I didn't remember this story. After the dinner was over, we were having a conversation about God and whatever. And in the Chabad philosophical tradition, the mystical tradition, you know, I shared with him my experience and my knowledge that in our tradition, God is a very personal to each of us. God is not this abstract being that's out in the ethers and is looking down at the universe, but God is very personal. If you choose to, there's a saying, where does God reside? The answer is wherever you let him in, right? So if you open yourself up to a relationship with God, you will find a closeness to God. And I shared that with him. And he shared this at this dinner 5 or 6 years ago. And he said that that was the moment that he decided to enter into recovery, because he suddenly found that he could have this relationship with God. So what I'm saying is, you never know where you change a person's life. I think the biggest challenge is that we further the stigma by being uneducated about what the struggle really is all about. And if we can educate ourselves about what the struggle is, and as I shared, to see ourselves in the struggle of addiction, even if we're not addicted to a substance or a particular damaging behavior, but if we can see ourselves in the struggle, we will open ourselves up to sympathy towards others who are struggling, empathy towards others, and that alone will minimize the stigma. And just a little bit of minimization of the stigma literally saves lives. Literally saves lives. I can't tell you the number of people who've told me, just they've never stepped foot into a meeting here, but just knowing that there's an AA meeting in a Chabad center, it's a game changer, right? Just to know that a Jewish space is hosting an AA meeting, like, what's wrong with that picture? And suddenly says, wow, oh, Chabad recognizes that this is a normal thing, that it doesn't need to be in the shadows. So if all of us get educated and become more comfortable and just open our hearts to those that are struggling, we can save lives, and we don't have to conquer the whole problem. There's a teaching in the Mishnah that says, it's not upon you to finish the job, nor are you a free person to exempt yourself from doing anything. I'm paraphrasing. But the idea is, yeah, no, God didn't assign me the job to fix the problem of addiction in the world. But God also didn't say you can just sit on the sidelines and let somebody else do the work. I got to do my part. In every area of life where I can have influence, I'm required to do my part. And I think each of us have that ability. And God forbid, you know, it's 2-3 degrees of separation. Everybody knows somebody who died from an overdose, who did terrible harm or harm to themselves, you know, lost a loved one. It's prevalent everywhere. So we either get to be part of the solution Or you know, what's the saying that the only thing for evil to flourish is for good people to stand by and do nothing. So we all can do something. Let's do something. A little bit. And we can all make the world a little bit of a better place.
I love that. I love that, Rabbi. Rabbi Eliyahu Shusterman, thank you so much. Shabbat Shalom. What you're doing is Kiddush Hashem. You know, praising God. And may we all make the world a little bit better.
Thank you. And I am open. If anybody needs guidance or help or wants to learn about what we're doing, they're always welcome to reach out to me. Email, phone, whatever. I'll be happy to help. Anything that can help move this forward, I'm here for that.
So I will have the Jeff's Place contact on the show notes. And that's just for people living in Atlanta or?
Anywhere. Anywhere.
It's beautiful.
I'm a global person. Think locally, think globally, act locally.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.